Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the local edition on a Friday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. In the second half of the show, we'll learn about one of the last film photo booths in the world. It's right here in New York. But first, on the phone with us now is the one and only Chris Rowley from the Shawanka Journal, letting us know what's happening in Ellenville and Ulster County. Chris, welcome back to the program. This week, we're going to talk about a repurposed sign that used to be a mainstay in Ellenville in Liberty Square. That's why I mentioned Liberty. And the Wayside Inn, which has been converted to an art studio and things like that. And now it's sort of this new sign is going to be sort of a sign for the new art district in Ellenville. What can you tell us about this?
This is a story about the remnants or a remnant of the old Wayside Inn, which was an enormous, I'm not sure, they had to be way up there in terms of rooms, 100 plus rooms. It was in mock Tudor style. It was on the corner of Liberty Square and Canal Street, you know, right in the heart of modern-day Ellenville. And it burned down in 1967, which was a very sad day. Really must have been terrible. And it has been replaced with a building nowhere near the scale of the Wayside Inn. But one thing that survived was the Canal Street end of the structure, which was the restaurant for it. All these hotels had big restaurants. And that restaurant area has been converted into a bar most recently, the public house. And there's the B&B's breakfast and lunch place next door to it now. And then the other end is, Robin Squire's art installations. She's got an art. He's turned the whole thing into an art studio. And so Robin Squires, now this is a story Robin Hager, a great writer, Robin Hager. She's writing about Robin Squires. And she spelled Robin the same way. So R-O-B-Y-N. And so this is kind of cute that way, but it's a great piece. And basically what Squires has done is paint the sign, bring it back from being just a rusted testament to a former time,
right?
And she's painted it, and at the top it says art district, because there's now an axis of art galleries from her gallery space over on the northern side across Canal Street and along Market Street, where there's two or three more gallery spaces. And Paul Valinsky's gallery at 9 Market, which is a magnificent space. Ellenville is acquiring a kind of a Sohoization, you know, in terms of becoming a place for arts and galleries. And so she put that up there. And then down the long central part of the sign, it says Ellenville. Now, of course, nobody can afford to get the neon back, but this gets this sign back from being just a mysterious testament to a long gone age to having a function and right. Telling people what's going on. And so, you know, in that way, it's kind of interesting, you know, and of course the days of the grand hotels, I mean, for now that's over. I mean, we don't see anything like that. Although we do wait with bated breath on something happening to the old Neverly property, where we're told to await something exciting any day now. We'll have to see. But the idea of a 100-room hotel being built anywhere in our area is sort of unlikely.
Yeah, and also what also changes is sort of the architecture. I'm looking at a postcard right now of the Wayside Inn in Ellenville. I'm not sure what year it is. This is coming off the Ellenville Public Library, and, you know, these massive wooden structures that, you know, unfortunately don't exist anymore, this type of architecture.
Yeah, I know. It's a testament. I mean, a lot of those pictures, you can tell what era it is by looking at the cars. If there's a car being driven in to be parked or to get valet service, look at the car, and you usually will see that it's a 50s, 60s car. Back in the days when American cars were like many feet longer than they are now and had fins.
Yeah, funny you say that. Exactly what I'm looking at. I'm looking, is it now a color postcard? It looks like a 50s car with fins on it. There's a restaurant right next to the inn. There's a wayside hotel on the other side. I see a big shop there. So,
yeah, the restaurant part of that building is survived, and that's still there. Currently, it's a bar, and it's another kind of piece of history. But the hotel burned, and some of those cement pillars are still there as well. Yeah, it must have been a dramatically terrible night that in 1967. But the sign has been brought back. There are art galleries and art shows. There's a genuine pulse of excitement concerning the arts in Ellenville. A lot of new people, young people, and a few older people are here. They've come. Many came because of COVID, getting out of the city and so on. Others just came and visited and then decided this is a lovely place to live and came back. And they're here. They're grabbing every possible space and turning them into little art galleries, although there's also a couple of boutiques, there's restaurants. You know, Ellenville has got a little bit of a life back to it from where it was, say, 25 years ago.
Right.
Now it's pulsing along, and you've also got the Shadowland Theater, which is an important component here, which has actually two stages. They've got the main theater, and now they have the other theater, which is on Market Street, right across from Mr. Valinsky's gallery, which I should mention he shares with Amy Park, who is a very well-known artist. So, we're getting people like that. Amy is shown all around the world. We're getting important artists coming, setting up in Ellenville, and providing that little bit of gloss to this little village in the hills. And now, Robin Squires has brought back the sign, which had been kind of a bit mysterious. I mean, you'd see people come to the theater and walk up and down Ellenville and notice what was going on in the storefront mm-hmm. as they filled back up. And they'd stop and stare at the sign, and probably nobody knew what it was. And it was just a sort of odd, because it's, it's 25 feet high. There's an odd, large symbol of something that's long gone, and no one knew it, and it was a little bit sort of odd. But now it's telling the world that this is the Ellenville Arts District, which is sweet,
So I'm trying to look at a Google Maps as you talk. This, I do see the restaurant. Well, this is taken in 2024, the Google Maps, and I do see the former restaurant looks like it did in the postcard. Oh, this is close. Yep. This is close to the. Oh, this is Liberty Square. I know where this is. Okay.
Yeah, it's Liberty Square. It's kind of hard of downtown. Mm-hmm. If people only go for like the Blueberry Festival or something like that, they're familiar with Liberty Square. Of course, they only see it when it's got the pickle gone in the corner and and all the crowd, But it's Liberty Square, and it's where ceremonies and various things happen. Sometimes music events, like last night, Ellenville had its 24th. Iteration of the ceremony marking the terrible tragedy of September the 11th, 2001. That day, which we'll never forget.
Right. So
it's often used for like serious ceremonies like that, and it's often used for fun things as well. That's Liberty Square, which has been the kind of heart of the village since. I did research on this once upon a time, and we found at that time that all began with a crossing of two trails, which probably explains why it's curved. One of the trails turned eventually into Canal Street. The other one turned into Market Street and then Liberty Square, Liberty Street. And at that time, the earliest structures in the whole village were there. One of them was a lean-to on the corner of what became Market Street and Canal Street, on the same site as where the Shongum Journal used to have its offices, which I thought was kind of sweet. And then across the street, there was a house and a tavern were built, And then the village sort of got going, and about 20 years later, got its name from this young lady named Ellen Snyder, who actually lived most of her life in Kingston.
Wow.
odd sort of thing. But about the same time as it got its name, Ellenville also got the canal. And the canal is why Ellenville's there.
Right.
Because the canal brought the boats that brought the sand from New Jersey, and to marry up with, first of all, wood, and then coal from Pennsylvania for Ellenville Glass. And the glassworks was a very large industrial facility at the eastern end of the village that operated for a good 50, 60 years. And all over America in that time, this is the time of Conestoga wagons heading west and all that. That the time of, think about it. You know, it's the time that Mark Twain wrote about as in romantic glory in his past.
Right.
Some of the 1840s and 50s. And people had these big flagons and jugs of Ellenville glass in their wagons. And those things went all over the country. Big bottles and big glass, heavy-duty glass stuff that would really take a beating. And that was Ellenville's key to prosperity. That set it up. And out of that came the churches, a lot of housing, and the prosperity of the village in the late 19th century. Yeah, the canal was very important.
Right.
But before that, there was an Indian trail. I mean, sorry, Lenape Trail. That ran right through there, on which the early settlers built their first houses.
Yeah, but what isn't 209 supposed to be one of the oldest trails or roadways in America?
It is. It has that. I mean, there are disputes about the name of it and everything. I know that our newspaper's prime historian, Mark Freed, disputes the old mine road concept. He thinks that's a late innovation added to the story. But yes, it is. That road is goes way back, one way or the other. Yeah, you know, so that era. But now the sign of the end of the hotel era, because Ellenville had lots of hotels and boarding houses. The whole world has gone except for the sign. And now it's been repurposed, and it's announcing the Arts District, which I find kind of a very sweet reuse.
All good stuff. It's Ellenville coming up again and you know, revitalizing, reusing some of the things in the past for new use. You know, now they have the signage used to guide visitors to the hotel, and now guide visitors to the fledgling and upcoming art scene that's happening in Ellenville.
Yay. Yes, indeed.
Definitely. All right, Chris, thank you so much for that. We're talking to Chris Rowley from the Schwanker Journal, letting us know what's happening in Ellenville and Ulster County. Don't go anywhere. In the second half of the show, we'll learn more about color photo booths. One of the few remaining ones in America and right here in New York. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Local Edition, and I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
When you really drill down on what President Trump was saying about Charlie Kirk's assassination, you know, you've got him sort of blaming the radical left for creating the conditions that allowed, that gave permission for somebody to assassinate this guy.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
You tell yourself you're not going to eat anything sugary today. But then at dinner, your waiter gives you a free milkshake.
Basically, what was I going to do, right? Like, I didn't want to sugar my kids up anymore. Milkshakes are delicious.
How our brains hijack the best of our intentions. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Monday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to the local edition on a Friday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. It's been 100 years since the invention of the color photo booth, which used a chemical dip and dunk process to develop images on the spot. Today, only one remains in operation, and it's in Berlin. But for decades, a quieter, lesser-known booth ran out of an old arcade in Selvin Beach, New York. It operated on a stockpile of supplies bought in the 1990s, and it stayed alive thanks to one family's dedication. It was something that you don't find trending online. It was a local fixture, hidden in plain sight. And today, Radio Catskill's Jamie Kay speaks to Emily Oteo, a photo booth enthusiast, about the final season of the Sullivan Beach booth, its quiet legacy, and how it was passed from one passionate family to another.
So when did you first become aware of the Sullivan Beach photo booth?
Probably around about 4 years ago. So I'm from Manchester in the UK originally, and I moved to Canada in around this time in 2021. And like, side history about me and photo booths is that for the last sort of maybe 20 years, anywhere that I've gone that is new, I have tried to find where the nearest one is to me. And when I moved to Canada, I lived just a couple of hours away from Toronto. There weren't any left in the eastern side of Canada, really, apart from one in northern Ontario. And the closest ones I was finding were all in upstate New York and like various ones around Michigan, whatever.
Also, I'm just curious, how did you find, you know, the photo booth? Because there's so little information about this one specifically online.
We have a website called photobooth.net. I say we, the community of people who are obsessed with them. And they had it listed on there. Again, that was my primary source of information. But one thing about photobooth.net, as amazing as it is as a resource, a lot of the locations are out of date. So if booths stop working or have, you know, broken or moved or changed owners, because it's all crowdsourced information, sometimes it can take a while for that information to update. So oftentimes you'll see locations, you'll get there and, you know, the booth is long gone. And because I knew I was going to be driving for like 6 hours, I wanted to make sure before I set off it was definitely there. So I emailed David and Lisa to double check that it was still there. And he said, yes, it is. We have enough paper and enough chemicals left for the next 2 seasons. We only open it seasonally. So the second I heard that, I was, you know, I think the next day I left and went to visit. But yeah, I think especially with some more of these like small towns or like lakeside towns with arcades, they never ever got super popular just because of the booth. Like, unlike some of the New York locations that have gone viral or the LA locations that have gone viral, these are like hometown heroes. So the people that know about them know about them. They don't get a lot of like notice from anybody else. And I think for me, because it is so special, I wanted to make sure that I told as many people about it as possible, so as many people could experience it before it went. And, you know, the chemicals go bad either way. So I would rather have 200 more people using it than, you know, 20 people using it. Those chemicals are still going to, you know, end whichever way you look at it. So
in our initial conversations over email, you told me that once this analog color booth disappears, the only one left will be in Berlin. So I'm just wondering, you know, why is it so hard to keep these booths in operation?
So the first hurdle, like I mentioned before, is there was only one company in the world that made direct positive paper for color photo booths, which was a company called PhotoMe, who are based in the UK. And they developed the first color photo booth in the 70s. They made the paper. They were the only people that ever made the paper for colors. And they stopped producing it in 2005 when digital was, you know, taking over. It just wasn't a commercially viable thing to have manufactured anymore, which is, you know, it's understandable. They also didn't bank on the resurgence of people loving them, you know, 30 years later. So every color photo booth that has then been in existence in the world since then has been relying on stockpiles. And I mean, there's healthy stockpiles. Like, there will have been hundreds and hundreds of thousands of rolls of this paper left over. And the next hurdle is the chemicals themselves. So they vary slightly to the regular black and white chemicals for developing the black and white paper. And to be honest with you, some of it's quite nasty stuff. And environmental agencies have cracked down, particularly in recent years, and nobody really wants to manufacture it anymore. It's not very nice. It's dangerous to the people handling it. It's dangerous to the environment. So, you know, there's been a real reluctance for anybody to really, you know, continue to be producing this en masse.
And what is the difference between the color booths and the black and white machines?
So the machine themselves, Berlin is a different one. So I'll talk about Berlin in a second. The machine itself is the same, whether it is black and white or color when it's a dip and dunk machine. It is just about the chemicals and the timing in the chemicals and the paper. So the insides of the machine are the same. So all color photo booths can be made black and white if they are dip and dunk machines. And by that thing, I think all dip and dunk black and white machines can be made color. You just have to change some of the configurations. The machine in Berlin is actually a different machine altogether. It works on a system of rollers and tanks. So instead of the machine that you've probably seen that dips your paper around and then delivers it out, the paper feeds down and then goes through a series of rollers and a series of tanks with the different chemicals in. Those machines can't be made black and white because of the foam rollers. There's something about the black and white chemicals specifically that are too corrosive for those rollers. So as of now, that's not to say they won't figure something out in the future. The color booth in Berlin wouldn't be able to be turned black and white. So when, to the best of my knowledge, somebody may have figured that out, you know, between my knowledge and now. So when they run out of their stockpiles and when they run out of their chemicals, it's likely that they'll just remove that booth and it will go into storage or it will be harvested for parts.
When we initially connected, you also said that you hoped to purchase the booth from Sylvan Beach and you planned on converting it to black and white. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So when I went last year, and hats off to them because I must have sounded like a raving lunatic. David is well aware that it can be converted into a black and white booth. His view is he doesn't need to because he already has the black and white booth there. They actually used to have three booths at Sylvan Beach once upon a time, and he sold the third one for the same reason. He didn't need two black and white booths. And I don't know what came over me. I blurted out the first time I met him, would he be open to selling it? I mean, if I was to say that it had been a dream of mine for my whole life to own one, that would be a lie because, like, in my brain, they were owned by cool people and they were owned by businesses and they were owned by people that operated them. My brain did not fathom that I could at one point just decide to maybe purchase one and run it myself. So that realization only came maybe about 5 years ago. So yeah, I don't know what came over me. I asked if he would be interested in selling it. He said he'd think about it. We had quite a bit of back and forth over the coming month. I knew he still had chemicals and paper left for, you know, for the next season. And then a few months later, he emailed me. I sent him like a really long email of what I would do with it and why it was so meaningful to me and, you know, a bit of my history with using the booths. And a few months later, he emailed me back. He was like, we've given it a lot of thought and we'd be willing to sell it to you. And we have months to figure it out. It's going to be there for the next season. And, you know, you come up with a price that you think is fair. And yeah, and we've been in regular contact ever since. The second they actually opened it early for me in May so that I could come on Mother's Day and get pictures of all the family in the collar booth and get my youngest son's first birthday pictures done there, which was really special. And I have been every month since.
I know that you also mentioned plans for a kind of historical museum in the city. So I was wondering if you would like to talk about that a little bit as well.
The bunch of us that are obsessive nerds about these machines participate in something called the International Photo Booth Convention, which this year is being held in New York City to celebrate 100 years of the invention of photo booths as we know it. And she is hosting it along with another woman called Danielle, who runs and maintains the majority of the booths in New York City. And the people who run photobooth.net and some other contributors. She has had this idea in mind for a very long time, that she wanted to have a physical space to teach people about these machines, and that it's not just as simple as you go in, you pay $5, you get a strip. Like, a lot of work goes into keeping them running. Parts aren't in production anymore. So when things break, it is a community effort. You know, the people that run them around the world all kind of have to put their heads together. And she wanted to create a space that sort of tells that story a little better. I think there's been other places that have opened up, you know, spaces where there are multiple machines in a room, and that's really cool. But as a museum and gallery, we want to really showcase, you know, the history of why these are so important and what it takes to maintain them, and give people a place to experience different machines from different time periods. And we've got some really unique historical artifacts from, you know, companies that used to manufacture them. And we're hoping to also be able to have showcasing artists that have used the photo booth as their medium over the last 100 years. So it's a really cool space. Opening date is TBD, because it kind of depends on a few things and some timing, and we want to make sure that it's perfect before we fling the doors open to the general public, but it is coming very soon.
So what makes this booth specifically, you know, so special to you, especially compared to the ones that maybe have more online traction or are in bigger cities?
The fact that it's been this, you know, this family business that has been run for so long. I mean, the carousel itself has been in his family. Next year will be 100 years. So, you know, it's steeped in history and it's intrinsically linked with the town, and, you know, and then for it to be passed on to essentially another family business who is going to treat it that way and treat it with the respect that it deserves, I think, for me, feels very special. And, you know, he purchased the booth for $8,000. And, you know, his dad purchased it for $8,000 in 1991. And I'm purchasing it for $8,000 in 2025. And it feels like a full circle moment. And yeah, I just feel very, very privileged and very lucky that we've built such a lovely relationship over the past year. And it's a relationship that's going to last long beyond me taking the photo booth. Like, we've already said, we're going to take the kids back next year for their 100-year celebration. And, you know, this is a long-term relationship. And I'd love for wherever the booth gets placed, most likely, you know, near Toronto, I would love to be able to invite them to come and use it, you know, in its new space once I've refurbished it and turned it black and white. So, yeah, hopefully it's a relationship that lasts well after the booth, you know, has changed hands.
For more information on analog photo booths, you can visit @autophoto or @4poses5minutes on Instagram. For Radio Catskill, I'm Jamie Case.
And that does it for the local edition. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, I was your host, Patricio Robayo. Don't forget, tomorrow we have the Summer Jubilee. That's happening at Lou Beach. We'll be celebrating Radio Catskill's 35th anniversary. We're going to have live music and DJs. All ages are welcome, and all the proceeds will benefit Radio Catskill. This is happening at the Lou Beach Community House. Everyone, have a great weekend. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.